Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances. Yet the average pitcher gives up 4 runs every 9 innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own. But in altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
From the great state of Colorado, welcome to Adjusting for Altitude, a Colorado Rockies podcast analyzing the unique challenges faced by the players of the only MLB team above sea level, a mile above sea level. At that, streaming live Mondays at 8:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. That's the ideal time when we're supposed to start these streams. I've been a little bit late on the first two, but we'll get a hang of that the more we get into this live stream aspect of this show. We're streaming live on YouTube, Twitter, and Twitch. You can also go find the audio version of this podcast after the fact, audio streamed on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and iHeartRadio. I am your host, Christopher Nelson II. Lots to come on today's episode, actually. We'll talk some recent transactions and the performances of Connor Siebold, Brent Suter, Jake Bird, Jurickson Profar, and Ezekiel Tovar thus far in 2023. But before we do hop into it, as per usual, if you haven't listened to last week's episode, go ahead and do so. Last week, we discussed the contributions of Austin Gomber, Matt Caricitti, Pierce Johnson, Brenton Doyle, and Nolan Jones thus far in 2023. Add that podcast episode to your queue if you haven't heard it already. You should also go follow me on Twitter and Instagram at IamTheSecond to keep up with me and my life, or just interact with me about anything, not just Rockies baseball. As per usual, my DMs are always open. You can also reach me via email at adjustingforaltitude@gmail.com if you prefer to communicate with me that way. And today's question of the day for you lovely listeners at home is, how many ballparks have you been to in total? How many MLB ballparks have you been to over the course of your life? Personally, I've only ever been to Coors Field. I've driven by a few on road trips and such, places like Fenway Park up in Boston, Truist Park in the ATL, Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, but I've only ever attended a game at Coors Field. So let me know what stadiums you've been to in the comments below, in DM, or via email. It is completely and totally up to you. But with that said, the Colorado Rockies are still not doing very well. It is Monday, June 26, 2023, and the Colorado Rockies are 31-49. They're fifth in the NL West. They're 16.5 games back of the Diamondbacks for first place in the division, and 13.5 games back of the final wildcard spot in the National League. And it's only been a few days since our last episode, so there's only been one series that's occurred since we last convened. The Rockies hosted the Angels over the weekend at Coors Field and managed to take the series 2-3 over the Halos with a bit of history involved. Funny enough, the Angels outscored the Rockies 32-12 in that 3-game series and lost the series. Yeah, that made social media memes all across the MLB world over the weekend. It was the first time since 1897 when the Louisville Colonels beat the Chicago Colts 2 times in a 3-game series, despite being outscored 45-22 over that 3-game stretch. Those are the only two instances where such a feat has ever occurred. The series back in 1897, and the Rockies series over this last weekend, where a team gets outscored by 20 or more runs in total over a 3-game series and still won the series. So that was interesting, to say the least. Obviously, the major culprit for the large run differential in this weekend series was the game on Saturday evening, where the Rockies, donning their City Connect jerseys, no less, which have actually started to grow on me personally, I'm not going to lie, simply couldn't stop the Halos offense, particularly in innings 3 and 4 of that game. They gave up back-to-back-to-back home runs to start the third inning and gave up 10 runs in the third inning with two outs. Yeah, not good. And after the Angels tacked on another eight in the fourth inning, the Rockies headed to the fifth inning down 23-0. Absolutely embarrassing. What's funny is actually that Shohei Ohtani, arguably the best player in Major League Baseball right now, despite the offensive outburst that the Angels put up in this game, a three touchdown, two safety lead, if we're talking football terms here, of course, despite that offensive outburst, Ohtani only went 1-for-7 in that game, which was kind of hilariously ironic. But nonetheless, ultimately, I could rip on the team for giving up 23 runs in four innings if I absolutely wanted to. What matters most is that they won the series. A 25-1 loss is the same as a 2-1 loss in the record column, and the Rockies ultimately won the series for the first time ever, funny enough, at Coors Field against the Angels. Never won a series against the Halos here in Lodo. But it wasn't all negative. Like I said, Rockies won the series. They also hit their first Grand Slam in nearly 2 years. That was in Friday evening's win against the Halos. Elias Diaz hit what ultimately became the go-ahead and stay-ahead Grand Slam in the eighth inning of that affair. Probably the Rockies' main highlight of the weekend, in all honesty. But I've highlighted a few transactions as well that have taken place since Wednesday, and some interesting injury updates that we should also talk about as well. So, with that said, this is what's been going on.
The Colorado Rockies are a Major League Baseball organization with many happenings and occurrences. Chris, what's been going on?
All right. So the first piece of news we get to talk about on today's episode is that Zach Veen, one of the Rockies' top prospects, will miss the remainder of the AA baseball season with left hand surgery. Now, Veen needed the surgery to repair severe fraying and tearing in the quote-unquote extensor carpi ulnaris of his left hand. I'm not a doctor, so I don't know if I said that properly. I'm going to assume that I did at least say it somewhat close to properly. Ultimately, it's in his left hand, and as a left-handed batter, that would be the top hand on his swing. So ultimately, that's the number one reason why he's been significantly underperforming this season at AA. Veen came into 2023 with significant potential to crack the major league roster at some point towards the middle or end of this season if he continued showing signs that he was developing rather quickly as a prospect. He's still in his early 20s, so there's obviously no rush. Unfortunately, his stats thus far in 2023 in AA, nonetheless, have not been stellar. He's got a 209 batting average, a 611 OPS, two home runs, 24 RBI, stole 22 bases, which I guess is a positive for him. But for a guy who's been known for having home run pop in his swing throughout even his high school career, not even just his pro career, it's easy to say that that top hand, which is usually relied on for generating lift in a player's swing, not being able to have that fully healthy has significantly impacted his ability to perform to his strengths so far in 2023. So coming into 2023, he was top 50 prospect in the league. Veen was ranking actually at 28th on MLB Pipeline's top 100 prospects in Major League Baseball. But unfortunately, his performance struggles and now the hand surgery bumped him all the way down to 74th on the same list after they did their mid-season evaluation of prospects across the game. So we wish Zach a speedy recovery, of course. His estimated time of return to action is sometime around December 2023, so later this year, if all goes according to plan, of course. So we'll definitely be praying for a speedy recovery for Zach. But in addition to Zach Veen, Mike Moustakas was traded over the weekend as well. Now, this kind of struck some people a little bit strangely. Roughly half an hour after the worst loss in franchise history, they announced a trade with the team that had just humiliated them like a half an hour before, sending a very well-regarded veteran in Moustakas over to the Angels for a prospect starting pitcher. Now, I think this trade, all things considered, is a win for the Rockies. Moose was obviously on the older end of his career at 34 years old and probably not going to be back on the team in 2024. He was an expiring contract who they signed kind of in the middle of spring training to fill out a roster spot. He signed him to a minor league contract with a chance to make the team, thinking he could be all right in relatively infrequent appearances with the ball club while coming off the bench. So to get a decent prospect in return for a guy who at the beginning of the season wasn't really in the team's plans this season, is certainly a win from a transactional perspective, especially for a team in the Rockies who are rebuilding at this point in time, developing the younger talent that they have in-house. That said, the prospect they got back in return simply isn't going to succeed at Coors Field, unfortunately, which is why I was very hesitant to give the Rockies a win at all in this trade. Connor von Skoyak, I believe is actually how you pronounce his name, is currently 23 years old. He's at high A in the minor leagues, meaning he's probably a few years away from even contributing to the Rockies major league team at best. He's pretty tall. He's pretty lanky, 6'6", 230 pounds. In 2023, he's 4-3 with a 2.76 ERA in 62 innings pitched. He's got 56 strikeouts to 25 walks. That's very encouraging. And he's got a whip of 1.1, so walks and hits per inning. He's not giving up a ton of them. Overall, he's got some pretty good potential. Unfortunately, here's the kicker part, his potential will not be maximized if reached at all in a Colorado Rockies uniform ever. The highlights of Von Skoyak's pitch repertoire as a starting pitcher include a 91 to 93 mile an hour fastball and a 3000 RPM curveball. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, a very, very high spin rate pitch. I couldn't find the exact spin rate for his fastball, but if he's throwing a curveball with elite spin rate, it's a fair conclusion to say that at a minimum, his fastball has a decent amount of spin as well. Those two are usually correlated for most pitchers. Couple that with the fact that he's got a relatively low velocity fastball, I really don't see Von Skoyak panning out as a successful pitcher for the Colorado Rockies in the future, simply because he doesn't fit that mold that we've talked about many, many times on this podcast. So it is a win that the Rockies got at least something back in return for an aging veteran. Is it the guy that they got back in return who's going to end up being worth that trade at this point in the season? Probably not. All things considered, again, a win, but ultimately him as a player, Von Skoyak as a player, as a pitcher, is probably not going to pan out. The interpretation of success in terms of this trade is up to you. We're just going to have to see how this plays out ultimately going forward into the future. We also have some injury news to talk about really quickly. CJ Krohn is at long last back from his back spasm issues, and Brent Suter was placed on the 15-day IL with a right oblique strain. Now, if you're a Colorado Rockies fan, or the Colorado Rockies rather, I guess, in general, if you're making decisions for this team, you have one job as it pertains to CJ Krohn: get his trade value up before the July 31st trade deadline. That is your one job if you are a decision maker for the Colorado Rockies. The backlog at first base right now is absolutely crazy. CJ Krohn will obviously factor back in as the starting everyday first baseman for the Rocks because he's the veteran at the position. But with guys like Ellerice Montero, Michael Tolia, seen as the future of that position for the Colorado Rockies, they need more consistent playing time to develop at the major league level. So Krohn should not be on this team by the end of July. They can't make the same mistake they made last season by not trading Daniel Bard at the trade deadline on a similar type of expiring contract. Bard is obviously still here, but it's very clear that they should have traded him last season when they had the opportunity to do so. The Rockies need to see what they have in their younger players, especially at first base. And this is certainly a season for them to assess that youth type of movement, especially considering they've already seen it going on with several other positions, with guys like Tovar, guys like Doyle, Jones, becoming regulars at their respective positions. Krohn is a solid first baseman for a team that wants to compete this season, and I think the Rockies should definitely try and get something decent in return. But in order for that to be the case, Krohn needs to play and get his trade value up. So as it pertains to Suter now, obviously missing Suter for the next few weeks is going to hurt the Rockies bullpen. Like, we've already talked about him on previous podcast episodes, and we're going to talk about him in some more detail on today's episode. But when you don't have access to one of the best relievers in the sport, especially a guy like Suter, who works multiple innings in middle relief, you just got to weather the storm, so to speak, while he's on the injured list. We'll see how the Rockies do without him for the next few weeks. That'll probably mean Brad Hand gets a few more innings as the lone healthy lefty in the bullpen right now, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. Brad's been pretty good this season, but again, he isn't as effective as Suter, so we'll see how all of that ultimately plays out for the squad over the next few weeks. Another transaction we'll go over really quickly is that Nick Mears was recalled from AAA and Noah Davis was optioned back to AAA. This one doesn't really make a ton of sense to me. And I'll get to that in just a second. But I spoke very highly of Nick Mears a few episodes ago. So he's a guy who has an electric fastball and a low spin rate curveball, which means that he has the potential to succeed at Coors Field. And thus far, his curveball has had hitters at the MLB level absolutely clueless, in a limited but sufficient sample size, in my opinion. So he's still refining some technique and improving his fastball command. But ultimately, he's a guy who can definitely compete for a major league team at the moment. And it's good to see him back on the Rockies 26-man roster. He definitely deserves to be here during this sort of transitional period that they're going through. We'll see how much action he gets, especially with Suter on the IL. But ultimately, in terms of Davis being optioned back to AAA, I really don't understand the plan here. Like, currently the Rockies have four starters on the MLB roster. And last I checked, you typically want five starters in your MLB rotation. Davis, I figured, would factor back in as the fifth starter, like he was before he had elbow inflammation issues in May. But I guess that's not going to be the case. He's definitely got some other things he needs to work on as a younger pitcher, of course. But I figured they'd just let him ride with it and let him develop his skills at the major league level with the major league club. But I guess that's not the plan. He'll continue to develop at AAA. In terms of the Rockies' rotation, we're going to have to watch and see whether the Rockies move forward with the four-man rotation in the near future, whether they make another roster move in the coming days. Maybe they promote a guy like Peter Lambert to the starting rotation from his current long relief role, or maybe they just employ the opener method that they used against the Reds last Wednesday more frequently, where they start the game with a relief pitcher and use about 3 to 4 pitchers out of their bullpen on that particular day. Definitely something to keep tabs on. But the last story I want to cover before we get into five-man analysis pertains to our good friend Nolan Jones getting his service time corrected. You don't really hear this very frequently. He's now Rookie of the Year eligible in 2023. And a few episodes ago, that I talked about the rookie requirements for MLB rookies, pitchers and position players alike. In summary, a pitcher to be considered a rookie must not have pitched more than 50 innings at the major league level. And for a hitter to be considered a rookie, he has to have been on an active MLB roster for fewer than 45 days. Last week, I mentioned that Nolan Jones was initially promoted to the major leagues with the Guardians last year before he was traded to the Rockies, of course. And during his tenure with the Guardians last season, they incorrectly credited him with an extra day of MLB service time, which brought his total days on an MLB roster up to 45 going into 2023, making him originally rookie ineligible in 2023. They obviously corrected that now, removing the additional day, which means that coming into 2023, he really only had 44 days of MLB service, making him eligible now as a rookie in 2023, allowing him to qualify for an award like NL Rookie of the Year. The award is league-centric, for those of you who are unaware how the Rookie of the Year award works in Major League Baseball. The American League and the National League both have a player or a rookie who wins the Rookie of the Year honor. So there are two rookies of the year every year, technically. Now, Nolan's been great in his first few games with the Rockies in 2023. I talked about that on last week's episode. He's batting above 300. He's getting extra base hits, making fun defensive plays, even stealing bases, etc., because he's a five-tool player and he's just that cool. But in the NL right now, it's a tight field in the Rookie of the Year race, given that players like Corbin Carroll, Elly De La Cruz, Yuri Perez, Matt McLain, and Bobby Miller have been more dominant for more dominant teams thus far in 2023. Jones is certainly not going to be a front runner for the award, but at a very minimum, he qualifies for it. And if injuries or slumps start to occur with some of these other guys, you never know who just might take advantage of that and go and win themselves a Rookie of the Year award. But that's what's been happening transactionally within the organization over the past few days. Coming up next, we're about to discuss some in-depth analytics behind and adjustments for a few of the gentlemen donning the purple pinstripes in 2023. Three Rockies pitchers, two Rockies position players, five-man analysis is on the way in 60 seconds. Don't go anywhere. This is Adjusting for Altitude. Stay tuned.
The Magnus effect is defined as the force exerted on a rapidly spinning cylinder or sphere moving through the air or another fluid in a direction at an angle to the axis of spin. This force is responsible for the swerving of balls when hit or thrown with spin. The impact of the Magnus effect on a spinning cylinder or sphere at different altitudes is ultimately what makes playing baseball in Colorado significantly harder than most other states. With the lower atmospheric air density present in a city such as Denver, Colorado, less air resistance is experienced by the flying projectiles, in this context, a Major League Baseball. Pitches break less in any direction, batted balls fly farther, and the larger ballpark built to lessen the likelihood of a hitter's paradise in Denver only allows for more poorly batted fly balls to drop in the outfield. This is why playing baseball at altitude is a significant challenge for most who dare to succeed within the industry of Major League Baseball.
Welcome back to Adjusting for Altitude. This is Five Man Analysis.
Using advanced MLB analytics and eye test comparisons, let's discuss the performance of five Colorado Rockies thus far this season. This is Five Man Analysis.
And this is the pitchers segment of Five Man Analysis, and we will kick it off with player number one.
Player number one.
Player number one is Connor Siebold. Now, Connor Siebold is currently the third starter in the Colorado Rockies rotation, and here are Siebold's stats thus far in 2023. So far, he is 1-3 with a 5.88 ERA in 56.2 innings pitched. He's struck out 43 batters. He's walked 19. He has a 5.60 FIP, a 1.46 WHIP, a 0 WAR, and an 85 ERA plus, meaning he's 15% worse than the average MLB pitcher. Now, I don't think I've mentioned WAR on this podcast until today, actually. So I'll briefly explain the concept of WAR to people who might not understand what that metric is. WAR is bad, actually, and it usually results in the death of a lot of people. No, not that WAR. This WAR is actually an acronym. It stands for Wins Above Replacement. So WAR is a rather detailed discussion that you could have for a really, really long period of time with a lot of baseball nerds. Honestly, those conversations are really unnecessary. There are several different ways that people calculate WAR, and it can get really complicated really quickly. So all you really need to know about WAR is that it demonstrates the effect a player has on his team's record, roughly the number of wins that a player has contributed to his team as compared to a quote-unquote replacement level player. WAR is a cumulative stat. That means it gets added to and subtracted from based on the player's performance throughout the season as a whole to present a more balanced perspective of the player's performance throughout the season. This means that WAR can actually be negative, and that isn't a good thing. You do not want a negative WAR. WAR is calculated differently for pitchers and positional players from a formula perspective, but ultimately for both pitchers and position players, a replacement level player typically will have a WAR between 0 and 1 at the end of the season. A role player will have a WAR between 1 and 2. A solid player will have a WAR between 2 and 3. A good player will have a WAR between 3 and 4. An all-star caliber player will have a WAR between 5 and 6. And MVP caliber players will have a WAR of 6 or more. Again, the stat is cumulative. So if a player has, say, a WAR of 4 during the middle part of the season, that might suggest they've been a good player, but they could still finish that season with a lower WAR, say a WAR of 3 or 2, if that makes sense. So it fluctuates throughout the season, and by the season's end, you get the whole picture of the contributions that that player made to his team over the course of the season. I think WAR is a pretty good metric overall to look at if you want to determine, just at a very general level, how effective a player's contributions are. So in this instance, Connor Siebold has a WAR of 0 at this point in the season, effectively meaning he has not really been much more valuable than a replacement level player. Actually, he's been pretty much a replacement level player, meaning he is replaceable in theory. Siebold has achieved this stat line so far this season with the following pitch distribution. He's throwing his four-seam fastball 55% of the time at 93 miles per hour, his slider 30% of the time at 85 miles per hour, his changeup 13% of the time at 81 miles per hour, and his curveball 2% of the time at 79 miles per hour. Now, this repertoire has placed him in the following percentiles across Major League Baseball. He's in the 44th percentile of average exit velocity surrendered. He is in the 55th percentile of hard hit percentage, the 36th percentile of barrel percentage, the 13th percentile of strikeout rate, the 63rd percentile of walk rate, and the 10th percentile of whiff rate, and the 6th percentile of chase rate. So overall, Connor has not been a very good pitcher for the Rockies this season. His ERA plus was actually 97 last time we talked about him on this podcast, meaning he was only 3% worse than the average MLB pitcher at that time about a month ago. So he's significantly regressed as a whole. While he's improved at generating strikeouts, he's regressed in terms of generating softer contact, as best explained by his regression from 68th percentile to 36th percentile in barrel percentage. Again, balls hit at least 95 miles per hour off the bat. So his overall batting average on just all his pitches in general has also gone up. I don't remember what it was earlier in the season, but right now his overall batting average against is .284, and the average MLB hitter is batting .248 in 2023. So clearly he's being hit well by other hitters. He's throwing his changeup about 3% more and his slider about 2% less since the last time we talked about him a month ago, which is an encouraging sign for him, seeing that his slider has a lower than ideal spin rate of about 2,400 RPMs, and he has a batting average against of .314 on that pitch. While his changeup has a great 1,900-ish RPMs on it and is only being hit at a batting average against of .200, which is pretty darn excellent. Earlier in the season, his changeup had me very concerned, though, because it had a batting average against over .400 and an expected batting average of something like .375. It wasn't much better. As his third most used pitch, that's not good. Siebold's changeup was actually touted as one of his best, if not his best, pitch when the Rockies acquired him over the offseason from the Red Sox. So, I mean, as a whole, it's very encouraging to see that it's now playing up to expectations. There's still obviously a lot of work that Siebold has to do, though. But is throwing his changeup more the only adjustment that he needs to make? Obviously, he started making it, but is there anything else he can do to become more effective and get back to being sort of an average, if not above average, MLB pitcher? Well, let's compare him really quickly to Mike Clevinger, who's currently a starter for the Chicago White Sox. Here's what Clevinger's stats look like in 2023 so far. So far in 2023, Clevinger is 3-4 with a 3.88 ERA in 62.2 innings pitched. He struck out 53 batters. He has walked 26. He has a 4.88 FIP, a 1.36 WHIP, a 1.6 WAR, and a 113 ERA plus, meaning he's 13% better than the average MLB pitcher. And Clevinger's pitch distribution looks like this. Currently, he's throwing his four-seam fastball 49% of the time at 94 miles per hour. He's throwing his slider 28% of the time at 80 miles per hour. And he's throwing his cutter 9% of the time at 85 miles per hour. His changeup 8% of the time at 86 miles per hour. His curveball 3% of the time at 76 miles per hour, and his sinker 2% of the time at 93 miles per hour. So an immediate difference we notice between these two pitchers is that Clevinger simply throws more pitches. He throws six. But in terms of similarities, which is really where we want to live here, we notice immediately that Clevinger and Siebold both use their fastball and slider most of the time, and both possess lower spin rates on those pitches. Clevinger's fastball and slider respectively have RPMs of 2,300 and 2,400 RPMs, very similar to Siebold's fastball and slider RPMs of 2,100 and 2,400 respectively. Clevinger's fastball has a batting average against of .280, while Siebold's has a batting average against of .288. Fairly similar and really not very good. So not much to address there. That kind of just is the way it is at this moment in time. But in terms of their sliders, there is a major difference. Siebold's average slider velocity is 85 miles per hour, like I just said a little while ago. Clevinger's average slider velocity, however, 80 miles per hour. While it's not ideal to have a low spin rate slider, which both of them have, the low velocity that Clevinger throws his slider at somehow deceives hitters, and oftentimes they get under it, generating an average launch angle of 25 degrees, which is outside the ideal launch angle range of about 15 to 20 degrees. This wouldn't really matter if Clevinger didn't have success with that slider type of build with the low spin rate, lower velocity, but wait, he does. He has a batting average against of a mere 192 on his slider and an expected batting average against of 223. Both of those are very, very solid. This is definitely something that I think should be fairly easy to replicate if you're Connor Siebold with time, especially. So an adjustment that I'd suggest for Siebold, in addition to the trend of throwing more changeups, would be to slow down that slider, throw it at a lower velocity. I said this about a month ago. I said that Siebold should throw his curve more because it has the potential to be his best pitch, even though it has like a batting average against of 333. It had an expected batting average against of 105. So that was an initial suggestion I made to him. He really hasn't done that, but maybe like a slurve of some sort might benefit Siebold, getting that velocity down to about 80 to 82 miles per hour and generating some new funky movement. I don't know. But I think ultimately I'd be down to see Siebold utilize that type of three-pitch mix of fastball, of changeup, of slurve in some sort of 50-30-20 type of usage distribution. And it might even allow him to step into the realm of Coors Field success, seeing that he's really not currently built to succeed at Coors Field. Something he should consider, ultimately.
Player number two.
So player number two is currently a middle inning reliever for the Colorado Rockies who's capable of pitching multiple innings if necessary. And this guy's name is Brent Suter. Now, if this name sounds familiar at all, it would be because we talked about him briefly last week as a comparison to Matt Caricitti. But now we actually get to talk about the real deal, the actual thing. And here is what Brent Suter's stats look like thus far in 2023. So far, he is 4-0 with a 2.81 ERA in 41.2 innings pitched. He's struck out 33. He's walked 14. He has a 3.39 FIP, a 1.18 WHIP, a 0.8 WAR, and an ERA plus of 178, which means he's 78% better than the average MLB pitcher. And he's doing it with this type of pitch distribution. He's throwing his sinker 33% of the time at 88 miles per hour, his four-seam 30% of the time at 86 miles per hour, his changeup 28% of the time at 76 miles per hour, his slider 9% of the time at 76 miles per hour, and that is his entire repertoire. And with this repertoire, he's actually become one of MLB's most effective relievers. In 2023, he's in the 99th percentile of average exit velocity surrendered, the 99th percentile of hard hit percentage, the 97th percentile of barrel percentage. Despite being in the 22nd percentile of strikeout rate, the 52nd percentile of walk rate, the 13th percentile of whiff rate, and the 16th percentile of chase rate, he's an absolute anomaly, I think is the conclusion that we can come to. But what makes Brent so effective is the fact that he doesn't fit the modern MLB. Funny enough, he's deviated from the mean, so to speak. The average MLB pitcher throws a fastball that's 94 miles per hour. They have a high spin rate on that pitch typically, and they have solid breaking pitches to support their fastball, oftentimes with a solid off-speed pitch as a solid tertiary pitch in their repertoire. Hitters are so used to preparing for pitchers like that, that when they face a guy like Brent Suter, it's almost an entirely new experience. Like Brent throws just a 2100 RPM, 87 mile per hour fastball. He throws a 1600 RPM, 76 mile per hour changeup everywhere in the strike zone, and he literally just dares batters to hit them. That's literally how Brent Suter rocks and rolls. The number of times I've seen Brent Suter throw a middle changeup at like 77 miles per hour, just to have the hitter foul it back to the screen because they were late on the pitch, a 77 mile per hour changeup, they were late on it. That's just, it's incredible. It just speaks to how effective he's been. Now, obviously, it's not sustainable to throw changeups down the middle, because last time I talked about Brent on this podcast, he was much more dominant in all aspects of his game. But even despite his recent regression, he's still great, and I do anticipate that he will stay that way, all things considered. Why? Well, just look at the output he generates. The highest batting average against he has on any particular pitch that he throws, any of his four, is on his sinker. And that batting average against is 273, with an expected batting average against of 245. His fastballs generate an average 9 degrees of launch angle. Batters can hardly get it airborne. His off-speed and breaking pitches generate an average launch angle of 24 degrees. Batters can hardly stop popping it up. Brent is literally just an amazing pitcher to watch, and his statistics say that as well. Will he remain 78% better than the average MLB pitcher? Personally, I don't think so. But can he remain significantly better than the average MLB pitcher? I do think he can. I don't see why he can't. The only adjustment I can really recommend for Brent would ultimately be to just stay in the strike zone more while not throwing pitches down the middle, but still ultimately throwing it in there and trusting his stuff and just watching the beauty unfold, because it really is beautiful. If you've ever seen Brent Suter pitch, it's going to leave you just wondering, how is that even possible? He's walking currently about 3 batters per 9 innings, which isn't bad, but isn't great. So like I said, if he trusts himself to just throw his pitches in the strike zone, heck, even if they are down the middle, it's just hard to hit for whatever reason. I don't know why people struggle to hit it. They just seem to struggle with it. He will be more successful if he doesn't put runners on base, because when he puts runners on base, like every pitcher in general as well, the more runners you put on base, all of a sudden those base hits that happen become a little bit more deadly. So even though he's going to be out with injury for like the next few weeks, when he returns eventually, you are going to want to watch him during his outings. And what you're going to want to watch for is whether he's walking batters and getting himself into hitter-friendly counts. Because if he's doing that a lot, he's probably not going to have a very good day. It's going to be a rough outing for him. But if he's challenging batters to hit his pitches as they are, where they are, he'll likely be more successful than not. And that's exactly what we want to see out of Brent.
Player number 3.
Player number 3 on today's episode is Jake Bird. Now, Jake Bird has had his role kind of vary throughout the course of the season, but currently he's right around a 6th or 7th inning setup reliever for the Rockies, occasionally tasked to throw 2 or so innings. And here's how Jake's stats look thus far in 2023. So far, Jake is 1-1 with a 3.22 ERA in 50.1 innings pitched. He has 48 strikeouts to 16 walks, a 3.01 FIP, a 1.25 WHIP, a 1.1 WAR, and that's good for an ERA plus of 155, meaning he is 55% better than the average MLB pitcher. And he's doing it with this pitch distribution. Sinker is thrown 62% of the time at 94 miles per hour. The curveball is thrown 20% of the time at 82 miles per hour. And the cutter is thrown 17% of the time at 90 miles per hour. This repertoire balances him in an intriguing way, in my opinion, across the MLB percentile rankings. Currently, he's in the 36th percentile of average exit velocity surrendered, which isn't great. The 23rd percentile of hard hit percentage, which also isn't great. The 63rd percentile of barrel percentage, which is surprisingly encouraging. The 49th percentile of strikeout rate, so right around average. The 56th percentile of walk rate, which is slightly above average. The 20th percentile of whiff rate, which is not good. And then the 5th percentile of chase rate, which is really not good. But ultimately, overall, I think Bird has been a solid pitcher for a Rockies team that at this point in time just needs solid pitching. But what's interesting is that he actually has a similar issue to Pierce Johnson in terms of their breaking pitch being the curveball. And we talked about Pierce on last week's episode, but I'm going to bring Pierce back today. Pierce has made a return to the show simply not even a week later, about 5 days later since we talked about him last, because it's really an issue worth exploring in more detail. The struggles of Colorado Rockies pitchers who throw high spin rate curveballs. So much like Pierce Johnson, Jake Bird does throw a very high spin rate curveball, about 2,800 RPMs, which puts him in the 91st percentile of curveball spin in Major League Baseball. So I explained in detail last week how Pierce is simply not going to experience any success with that pitch at Coors Field. His curveball is 2,900 RPMs for recollection, if you forgot how spinny his curveball truly was. It's just simply too spinny. 2,900 RPMs, the Magnus effect does not like spinny curveballs, generally with more 12 to 6, 1 to 7 type of movement across like an analog clock face. So pitches that are curveballs with that type of movement, Coors Field is not going to be that pitch's friend. But some astute listeners on last week's episode might have realized something in listening to me talk about curveballs, the way they move, etc. They might have realized that I ignored pretty much completely the horizontal movement aspect of curveballs. While curveballs are known for their rather up and down vertical movement, most curveballs also have a decent amount of horizontal movement as well. So last week I noted that Pierce Johnson's curveball moves about 4 inches less vertically, and I attributed that to the altitude that he plays at Coors Field. But what I didn't note is that his curveball, Pierce Johnson's curveball, moves 4 inches more horizontally. Either in my initial analysis of Pierce or when comparing his curveball to Ryan Pressly's, it's just not an issue that I covered. So we'll talk about it in a little bit more detail here. This might be a fair thing to discuss in general, but there's quite honestly a reason I avoided talking about it on last week's episode, because it's really not worth discussing. And here's why. The more slider-like gyro spin, so to speak, that you have on your curveball, the more 1 to 7, 2 to 8 type of spin across an analog clock face that you have on that pitch, the more movement you'll get and a higher spin rate will be better in that instance. Why? Because that's just the way it works when it comes to the Magnus effect at Coors Field. That's why sliders are the superior Coors Field breaking pitch. That type of spin just plays well, like within a half an inch worth of vertical and horizontal difference in movement between Coors Field and other venues of lower altitude. So what does Pierce generating 4 inches more horizontal movement tell us about both Pierce and Coors Field, I guess? Well, first off, it tells us that Coors Field really isn't as harmful to curveballs as I once thought. No, I'm completely joking. That was a complete joke. You'll pick up on my sarcasm the more this show gets in and out on the interwebs. Nope. It simply just tells us that Pierce throws a curveball that is it moves more horizontally than vertically. That's really all it's telling us. He throws it less 12-6 and more 2-8 across your analog clock face, as it actually is still pretty disappointing once you consider the fact that Pierce's curveball is still underperforming, even horizontally, because remember Ryan Pressly, the comparison that I made to Pierce Johnson on last week's episode, who throws a 3,200 RPM spin rate curveball, the highest spin rate curveball in the league. Ryan actually generates about 7 inches more movement horizontally on that pitch than the average MLB pitcher does with their curveball. So Pierce is still not generating as much movement either vertically or horizontally on that pitch. And it's actually right within that range that I predicted that he should be within, about 2 to 3 inches worth of difference. I said Pierce should be experiencing about 2 to 3 inches more worth of movement, both vertically, horizontally, just movement in general. I talked about it from a vertical perspective, but from a horizontal perspective, ultimately that is literally the case. He's experiencing about 3 or 4 inches less of horizontal movement. But I'm getting a little bit sidetracked here. How does this ultimately apply to Jake Bird, which is the guy we're talking about on today's episode? Jake's curveball is actually really effective, somehow, some way. It might be very spinny. It might be in the 91st percentile of curveball spin rate, but it has a batting average against of 0.085. That's pretty darn good. And the expected batting average against is pretty good too, at 0.099. It's really effective. He does generate about 1 inch more of vertical break as compared to the average MLB pitcher, and 6 inches more horizontal break than the average MLB pitcher does as well. So clearly Jake throws a curveball that profiles well, and fairly similarly to Pierce Johnson's curveball too. But then why is it that Bird isn't feeling the same impact that Johnson is feeling in terms of struggle? Johnson started the year off very strong, and he started to sort of tail off. over the last few weeks and come back to the mean and even regress below the mean, as we saw on last week's episode. So why is that? Why is Bird not feeling the same impact that Johnson is? Well, I mean, ultimately, they both throw a high spin rate curveball. That's their primary breaking pitch. So this doesn't seem to make sense. Well, some digging uncovered the fact that Jake has actually thrown 48% of his 50 innings so far this season away from Coors Field. More than half have been on the road. Pierce has thrown 43% of his innings away from Coors Field, which means that he's thrown most of his innings at home. Ultimately, on top of that, Bird away from Coors Field has an ERA of 2.42. That's pretty good. 24 strikeouts to 6 walks and a 2.45 batting average against. Away from Coors Field. At Coors Field, in fewer innings pitched, he has a 4.07 ERA, 24 strikeouts to 10 walks, and a 2.58 batting average against. Pierce found out the hard way the struggles of using a spinny curveball in order to be a productive pitcher at Coors Field. He found out that that simply isn't a method for sustainable success in the long term as a pitcher whose home ballpark is Coors Field. Jake might be an above average pitcher for now, but once his innings at Coors Field continue to increase, that's not likely going to be the case. If he doesn't rely more on his cutter to balance out his sinker, and rely more on his fastballs that he has in his repertoire. His current sinker is actually really ineffective. It has a batting average against of 294. So if he doesn't work on getting that cutter to help balance out that sinker, which has been ineffective so far, he's likely going to go the way of Pierce Johnson, just a good reliever who simply has not found a way to build a repertoire that can succeed at Coors Field. So he needs to throw that cutter more. He needs to throw the sinker less. He needs to throw his curveball a little bit less, preferably in usage rates balanced right around 50, 35, 15 in terms of sinker, cutter, curveball, respectively, if he wants to maintain his current success that he's had, if you can call it that, looking at those home road splits. Otherwise, disaster may very well await Mr. Bird. In his appearances, you're going to want to watch and see if Bird uses his cutter more frequently during the course of those outings. So it's certainly a pitch in development. He started throwing it a little bit more as the season has gone on, but ultimately it needs to better develop, and you can't develop that pitch unless you start throwing it more. And if he wants to succeed as a part of the Colorado Rockies' long-term bullpen plans, that's just simply going to need to be the case. Other than that, that will wrap up the analytics and suggestions for a few pitchers on today's segment of Five-Man Analysis, Adjusting for Altitude returns in 60 seconds with the hitters segment of the same show segment. So with that, stay tuned. We'll be back in 60.
As a smaller market Major League Baseball organization, the Colorado Rockies heavily rely on the draft and develop process to achieve success amidst their strugglesome circumstances. This process involves a greater reliance on drafting and signing young talent, patiently developing them within their minor league system until the organization believes they are ready to compete at the major league level. The Rockies have been more successful at developing hitters within their organization, players who can hit for average, power, and battle deep into counts on a relatively consistent basis, both at the hitter's paradise of Coors Field and on the road as well. In terms of pitching, the organization has struggled to produce successful homegrown depth in that regard. But historically, smart trades and free agent signings have been the primary way that the team plugs holes in the starting rotation and bullpen, both at the major league and minor league levels. The mastery of the draft and develop system will be crucial for the Rockies if they want to achieve sustained, long-term success at some point in the future.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Adjusting for Altitude. This is the hitter segment of Five Man Analysis. We're going to continue today's discussion with player number four.
Player number four.
All right, so player number four on today's episode is Jurickson Profar. Now, Jurickson Profar is currently the primary left fielder, although it kind of feels like he's more platooning these days with Randall Grichuk. Nonetheless, he's, for the most part, the primary left fielder for this team at this point in the season. He bats switch hitter out of the leadoff spot in the lineup usually, And here are Jurickson's numbers so far in 2023. So far, he has played 69 games. He's slashing .236, .315 with an OPS of .695. He's hit 6 home runs. He has driven in 27 runs. He struck out 59 times. He's walked 30 times. He has a WAR of negative 0.8. See, WAR can be negative, and that's not necessarily a good thing. And he has an OPS plus of 81, meaning he's 19% worse than the average MLB hitter. And across the MLB percentile rankings, Profar is in the 10th percentile of average exit velocity, the 36th percentile of max exit velocity, the 15th percentile of hard hit percentage, the 18th percentile of barrel percentage, the 66th percentile of strikeout rate, the 62nd percentile of walk rate, the 71st percentile of whiff rate, the 57th percentile of chase rate, and the 19th percentile of sprint speed, as well as the 44th percentile of arm strength and the first percentile of both outs above average and outfield jump, which is pretty much just reaction to balls hit in his direction as an outfielder. So Profar at the beginning of the season, kind of sort of the end of spring training, but the beginning of the regular season, was signed to be a solid leadoff hitter who could get on base well and play all right defense in left field. So far, I think he's generally done that. Unfortunately, he hasn't done it well. He doesn't strike out much, but he puts the ball in play really softly. He works walks, but he isn't a speed threat once he gets on base and is running the base paths. He sees fastballs most of the time and hits them pretty well at an average of .297, but he can't hit breaking or off-speed pitches, hitting both at batting averages under the Mendoza line, which is .200. Profar has begun to look more relaxed in the batter's box, however, as of recently, which has seemingly helped him, but I think ultimately he just needs to be more aggressive at the plate. If you're a guy who doesn't have a ton of five-tool potential at any stage of your career in general, but particularly for Profar, who has been around the game for a few years now, the ability to hit, well, again, the five tools are the ability to hit for average, for power, to run fast, throw hard, or field well. So if you don't possess those at this point in your career, you really do have to be more aggressive. And with that increased aggression usually comes a higher likelihood of success despite your limited five tool abilities. So for example, on Friday, Profar hit a home run on the second pitch of his at-bat and the second pitch of the game because he was batting leadoff. It was a fastball that he identified early in the count and jumped on. This is how Profar needs to succeed. So in his at-bats that you watch throughout the course of the season, just look to see if he's looking for pitches earlier in counts and trying to jump on them to avoid getting caught with a defensive approach at the plate late in the count, leaving him more susceptible to striking out or generating soft contact. So if he's doing that well, if he's using that type of aggressive approach throughout the game, limiting the amount of two strike counts that he gets himself into, he's going to be more likely to succeed and have a good day at the plate. Defensively, he's not really likely to make very many flashy plays, but he might make a diving catch every once in a while, so that's definitely something to monitor as well. Player number five on today's episode is Ezequiel Tovar. Currently a rookie and the starting shortstop for the Colorado Rockies, he bats right-handed out of the second spot in the lineup these days. Here are Tovar's numbers thus far in 2023. So far in 73 games, he's slashing .262, .296 with a .726 OPS. He's hit 7 home runs, driven in 33 runs, struck out 75 times, walked 11 times. He's 3-for-6 on stolen base attempts. He has a 1.1 WAR, good for an OPS plus of 86, meaning he is 14% worse than the average MLB hitter. And across the MLB percentile rankings, we see that Tovar is in the 32nd percentile of average exit velocity, the 53rd percentile of max exit velocity, the 24th percentile of hard hit percentage, the 43rd percentile of barrel percentage, the 22nd percentile of strikeout rate, the 3rd percentile of walk rate, the 22nd percentile of whiff rate, the 8th percentile of chase rate, the 72nd percentile of sprint speed, and the 94th percentile of outs above average and 65th percentile in arm strength. So at this point in his career and the season, Tovar is expected by many to be the future of the franchise. at shortstop for the Colorado Rockies. And as he continues to improve regularly regarding his technique in the batter's box, his approach at the plate, his gold glove caliber defense, which apparently to some is not hyperbole. In the eyes of many, he continues to play gold glove defense as a rookie at shortstop. He's going to continue developing into a very, very sneaky good five-tool player. And Tovar is obviously a rookie, like I said, and a young rookie at that. He's 21 years old. I think he's one of the five youngest players to debut in 2023. So he's got time to develop at the major league level. But the fact that he's already been entrusted with the second spot in the lineup is a sign that he's on a very quick developmental path. Overall, I think for him, he just needs to continue working on being selective at the plate, forcing pitchers to throw him his pitch more often. So like many younger players across the league and in baseball in general, he tends to swing at breaking balls way out of the zone, explained in part by his 168 batting average against on that pitch type, on breaking balls. He swings at these breaking pitches often early in counts, which sets him up to be tricked by that same pitch later in the count, or to just be sped up by a fastball, which then results in weak contact or just a simple late swing and a strikeout. Earlier in the year, he was fighting both his swing adjustments technically and his plate approach adjustments as well. So now that he's kind of refined his batting stance, having opened up his front foot, keeping it that way more consistently rather than reverting to his original closed stance when the count got to maybe two strikes, he can now focus on seeing pitches, reading breaking balls, and improving his plate approach with the technical aspect of his game more so in the rearview mirror in terms of what he's focusing on. And that will ultimately help him become a better hitter, especially out of the second spot. As a rookie, it's incredible that Bud has already entrusted him with that spot in the lineup. That's a pretty high profile spot. Now, I get that there have been a lot of injuries that the Rockies have sustained so far in 2023, especially from an offensive perspective. But I mean, he's there now, so I don't really see him being moved anytime in the near future. He's really starting to understand that role well in the lineup. He's learning to take pitches the opposite way, etc. So I think he's really putting himself in a good position to succeed with this team in the long term. But right now, when he's at the plate, you're going to want to watch to see how he handles breaking balls during the entirety of his at-bat. So if he's laying off of them, expect him to get his pitch more often and put it in a gap or even over the wall, like we saw in yesterday's game. He took a pitch away and he hit it over the wall opposite field. So on defense, you're also going to watch just to see how smoothly he plays the position. It's really quite fun to watch. It's one of those things that is not the most impressive. It's not going to stick out and stick off your screen, but he plays that position smoothly. And his smoothness is really, quite honestly, one of the reasons why many people think that he will eventually be an absolute superstar in this league. But with that, thank you for listening to this episode of Adjusting for Altitude, a Colorado Rockies podcast with me, Christopher Nelson II. We did cover a lot on today's episode as per usual, but if you've made it thus far or listened at any point to this podcast, I just want to remind you that your listenership is very much appreciated. I do pride myself in providing Rockies fans and MLB fans alike with high quality analysis about the team from the perspective of someone who does eventually want to work in the industry of Major League Baseball as a front office executive. And as such, I just hope you appreciate the depth in the perspective and the unique opinions, I guess, that I present on this podcast that are really not discussed anywhere else on the interwebs. Friendly reminder, if you missed any of the player analyses on today's episode, keep an eye on the Adjusting for Altitude YouTube channel and my personal Twitter account, although for whatever reason recently that's been acting very strange and my clips haven't been uploading. But check the YouTube channel for sure, because each discussion that we had about each player will be uploaded throughout the week, as well as any other major discussion topics that we have on any particular episode. So those will all be uploaded throughout the week. If you miss any of those, go ahead and check those out on YouTube and hopefully my Twitter. Again, you can find this podcast on YouTube, Twitter, and Twitch, and you can join us live every Monday evening, ideally at 8:30. I'm getting the hang of this whole preparation thing, so sometimes my prep takes a lot longer than I expected it to, but I anticipate that I'll be able to refine that the more I just get in the habit of doing this. So unfortunately, we started late tonight. Ideally, we'll be starting streams at 8:30 every Monday evening. You can also find the audio version of this podcast after the fact. You can stream that on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio. You can go follow me on Twitter and Instagram at IamTheSecond. You can also email me at adjustingforaltitude@gmail.com. And until next week, God bless and go Rockies.